It's great to be here with you all, many that I know and some that I do not know. So, yeah, I know we have a certain amount of time, so I could tell you tons of different things that are happening in Bolivia. Briefly, last summer, I was commended from North Lindo Bible Chapel, and that was a very big step. Nothing really changed in the ministry side of what I'm doing, but it was kind of a confirmation to continue on. It's been, I guess now it's been fourth, something like that. Oh, Brother Dan's here. Hey, good to see you. Sorry, I was just saying hello. Everybody look behind now. And it's a family setting. I think we are okay with that. So it was a big blessing, and it was a confirmation for me. And so this is the fourth year now, something like that, that I've been working. And when I first went down, I said, what am I going to do? I went to help my parents. Said, maybe I'll be for a little bit, and then I'll move on somewhere else. I was interested in Peru. Micah was telling me like crazy I needed to go there. And I was interested in Cuba, maybe going to see my brother in Turkey, now Cyprus. And you know what? Just for whatever reason, I kept staying in Bolivia and saying, oh, I kind of like it here. You know, there's things to do. And now I don't know how in the world I can leave. There's a lot to do. And I'm so thankful for the opportunities there that I don't deserve and that keep coming up. And I have such a fun time being involved with the Bible school. So I'm on the board now as of this year. Trying not to cause so much havoc, but trying to be on the student side, but also, you know, see how to improve it really. It's an awesome ministry that I think is one of my favorite things to be involved with there. Teaching 20, if you're 22 students, how to love the Bible, study the Bible, also have in-depth classes, college-level classes from teachers from different places. I teach 4 classes as well, and then to do manual labor, intensive discipleship one-on-one, and just in general ministry. So trying to make someone, a young Christian, have the tools to be useful in his church. Not giving them a title, but giving them tools to be more useful. So that's, I think, something very necessary in our context. I think it would be necessary here as well. I don't doubt it could be useful somewhere like the U.S. As well as the cost. It's very low cost, so that's kind of the key. So we can reach kids from all over. So we've had students from Argentina, now 2 years straight from Uruguay. It'll be 2 years straight from Peru. We've had a student as well. So we've had some students from the U.S. as well. So just a cool ministry. Also on the board of the radio. That's a different ministry. Very excited about that. People listen to the radio. They're audio learners. And there's a lot I could share on. I do some itinerant missionary ministry things. I travel 4 weeks out of 5 to a different town. And I do a circuit of 3 different cities, and one of them twice. It's a very large city, so I go to 4 churches. And then the one weekend I'm home, I preach at home. So it's not hard. I don't feel like preaching is something difficult. I think for some it can be, and for me it's really enjoyable. So I have no problem preaching 3, 4, or 5 times a week, and I find that really fun. Is that a word I'm allowed to use for preaching? But I do. So I'm sorry if that's supposed to sound wrong, but I really enjoy studying the Bible and teaching the Bible. I love teaching more than preaching, but still, it's a lot of fun. Involved with some kids ministries, involved with a bunch of different things. But one thing I would like to share with you before we get into Daniel, so I'm going to do my best to keep this really short. Not the message, this part. Okay. The message will come next. And we'll keep the message short as well. The radio ministry has been fun because I started recording material on the radio, not live. I don't want to do live because if you mess up or something, what do you do? You know, so recorded, edited into 30 little minute bite-sized pieces and big series. So one of my series is almost 30 part. Other ones are a little shorter. Stuff I've taught on, stuff I've preached on, and now there's over 100 hours of material in the last 2 years of recorded material, and that's what I love to do. I go to the radio, record, get edited, and the guy who edits makes me sound much better than I actually sound, which I really appreciate. And I had a friend of mine ask me about 2 years ago, hey, can I get this on a CD, or can I, you know, I missed part of your series on the radio, because it was coming out every night. And I said, yeah, I can figure that out. So I gave him one, and then the idea popped in my head and said, you know, I wonder if more people aren't interested in maybe listening to audio. And I realized, you know, the Latin culture is actually an audio learning culture. We learn very well by listening. We don't read. You'd be hard-pressed to find a Bolivian who's read more than 2 books in their life. I'm actually not kidding with you. I mean, that's probably true. Christians will read the Bible, but, you know, like a commentary or something like that, maybe a preacher will. But your average Christian or Bolivian or Latin will just watch TV, listen to the radio. And they'll gain a lot of information, but it's not from a book. So we'd be like, that's not good information. And you're right. But instead of battling and telling them you have to read books, what if we reach them with a way that they do know how to learn? So I decided to start putting this material on CD, and wherever I traveled, I would just carry some with me. So I started with one CD, then it went up recently to 5 CDs, actually almost 6 CDs recently, and I'd take CDs with me, make it on my laptop where I was going, and then I'd sell them basically a little under $1. So at cost, a little more, and then I'd just go to different places, and I'd take 100 at a time, and they'd just sell. They'd be gone. So as of a week before I came to the U.S., I'd sold 1,800 copies. So people are obviously really wanting to get material in Spanish. And they'll put it on their cell phone, they'll put it on a computer, place it to a DVD player. And for me, it was a shock. I didn't think it would be that interesting to people. I thought, you know, maybe a few would be useful. But turns out, I get emails from people on Facebook. I have a website where everything is absolutely free on there now, so you don't have to pirate, because I'm not going to let you. You just can download for free. So it's not piracy. And I'm, you know, there it is. And there's material from other people that I'm collecting on the website, and people are using it for Bible studies. They're calling me up, and then I meet them, and they're listening to it. I went to the jungle, actually, and there's a couple radio stations in Peru that have my material. And I was in a town where I went to a store to buy something. And it's a little jungle town, you know, barely some paved roads, a little bit of lights and water. And I go to buy something. She says, "I recognize your voice. Are you Christopher Maddox?" I says, "Yes." She says, "I hear you on the radio every day." I says, "Whoa, that's weird." You know, okay. I mean, so kind of crazy. But I think it struck a chord. I think people learn well with audio. So I've been, like I say, by a mistake, but God didn't make a mistake. He just opened my eyes to something that's happening there. Now it's on a DVD form, so I don't have to make tons of copies. I can just make one DVD, and then even lower the cost, because the DVD costs less than doing 5 CDs, and then get it out to more people. So, Lord willing, that'll be a ministry that continues and be more available. The website is very visited as well, about 40 people per day, and the guy who made my website said, "I haven't seen a website be this good." So, we'll see what happens. But I wanted to share that with you, because I think it's, in my mind, kind of a breakthrough as far as reaching Latin, because there is a lack of good material in Spanish, and they're not going to reach. So what do you do? Well, how about audio? Maybe that's the way to solve this problem in our modern era. So if you have any Spanish-speaking friends or something, or you want to learn Spanish, just let me know. I can pass you the website, and you can pirate for free and feel no guilt. Isn't that incredible? Incredible. So, all right, enough of that. Let's turn to Daniel chapter 6. I was at a kids camp last week, a little more than a week ago in New Mexico, teaching 11 to 14 year olds, my second time in a row. Man, what a fun age group. I didn't think I would have so much fun with them, but I did. And 13 messages, and they were paying attention and asking questions. We had a great time, and I went through the story of Joseph and Daniel. I really love the story of Joseph, the type of Christ, preview picture of Jesus Christ in so many ways, the life of Joseph, but also of Daniel. So I was preaching the gospel to them through the story of Joseph and Daniel. Daniel's a book I recently finished giving a whole series through at my home church, and Daniel's very interesting because it's written with story form, but it's also in a lot of prophecy. The eschatology in it is just insane. It's the revelation of the Old Testament. And I'm very excited about the theory of the Islamic Antichrist, so I was really digging into this book to find biblical evidence to support that. And we had a great time. I really enjoyed myself. Whenever you teach, you learn a lot. But also in the book of Daniel, there's story and some very impressive lifestyle teaching points from these young men who become, in Daniel's case, an old man that stays firm to God. And the thing that ties Daniel together from beginning to end, although it has story and prophecy, it is really one word. It's sovereignty. It teaches God's sovereignty. God is in control. The history of the world is written out beforehand. I'm not going to go excessive and talk this is about Calvinism. No, that's not what I'm talking about. Sovereignty, as in God, is bigger than everyone else. God has everything planned just like He wants it. And He uses men's decisions and all these things, but He's so wise, and everything is perfectly planned. Everything is perfectly orchestrated. How He puts kings and takes them down. And even in the future time, how He dealt with Daniel, but in the future, how He'll deal with the end times, and Christ will eternally reign. So it's the eternal victory of God, sovereignty in this book, but also integrity. Integrity of these young men who become
old men. In the case of Daniel, we know what happens when there's old men. The other men don't show up anymore. But when a book starts, they begin, if you do the math, most likely, and look at it historically, they're most likely about 13 years old when they started in the book of Daniel. Taken as very young men, educated for 3 years. In Daniel chapter 2, they would have been about 14 or 15 years old because it was just the second year of Nebuchadnezzar. And they came in the first year. Very, very young. And the things they do is astounding. They have wisdom because God gave it to them. They study very hard. They excel. And Daniel specifically becomes the right-hand man of Nebuchadnezzar. Then Belteshazzar happens. He is kind of, he's very dumb, politically speaking. He's very arrogant. He has some serious issues. And the kingdom is taken from him overnight in 539 AD by the king Darius. So the Babylonian kingdom falls. In one night, King Darius, the Medo-Persian, Darius, Cyrus, many would argue that it's the same person, as would I, and takes over the kingdom of Medo-Persia. The combination of Medo-Persia, which also takes over from Turkey all the way to almost India and as far south as Egypt. An enormous kingdom that expands Babylon. And King Darius is looking for an advisor. And you'd think the last person he'd seek is an advisor to the previous king, right? You wouldn't pick him, especially another man who, in this case Daniel, if we say he began his work under King Nebuchadnezzar, being educated at 13 years old in 605, now it's 539, we're talking he's 80 to 90 years old. That's his age range, somewhere around there. He's an old man. You would not choose him as your next candidate. And that's what's so impressive about this, because as we look at Daniel 6, we're going to see Daniel is a type of Jesus Christ as a previous picture to what Jesus Christ would be like. And the first point would be, you wouldn't pick Daniel to be your next leader. He didn't have the characteristics, and he seemed almost definitely the wrong person to do this. But he stood out, just like Jesus, the carpenter, the nobody from a little tiny town in the middle of the boonies of northern Israel. That is who became the most important person in history. So starting there, I want to look with you at Daniel chapter 6. It pleased Darius, King Darius of Medo-Persia, in his first year of the kingdom, or close to it, 539 before Christ. Did I say AD? I was saying AD, wasn't I? I was messed up with English, with Spanish. It's BC, before Christ. I apologize. So this would be 539 before Christ, not AD. To appoint 120 satraps to rule throughout the kingdom. An enormous empire, like I say, from Turkey to India on a modern map. And he divides into 120 states, if you will, and puts one governor over every single one of them, with three administrators over those 120, one of whom was Daniel. Daniel. Curious choice. I guess maybe he heard the story. Daniel prophesied the fall of Babylon. Daniel was an incredible advisor to King Nebuchadnezzar. His legacy preceded him. And Darius said, I want this man working for me. Very old man, but still had all his screws in place. He said, okay, I want you to work for me. And so Daniel becomes one of the three. The satraps were made accountable to them so that the king might suffer no loss. This was a useful idea. It is a general practice of good leadership, even in scripture, delegation. And here it happens, Darius is a very good ruler. Historically speaking, he is highly recognized as a great general, great thinker, actually someone who came out of a very small kingdom and took over and became a great emperor. But his story is pretty interesting all by itself. So here it goes. At this, okay, now Daniel so distinguished himself among the administrators and the satraps, unquestioned because of his wisdom, his insight into things, and also the help of God, by his exceptional qualities, that the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. And he's probably talking like, Daniel is just so great. Man, I'd love to just have him be my right-hand man, and I can just sleep at night, and he can worry about all these different things. And he's just talking to other people about it, and the other satraps are there, and the other governors are there, and they're like, well, why don't you make someone younger that position? What about someone who's not a Jew I mean, he's from a different country. He's not Medo-Persian. He's old. How many excuses can you come up with to say he's not the right guy for the job? Tons, right? He worked for your enemy. Isn't that enough? Let's go, Darius. I mean, oh, live forever, king, but hello, this is kind of a dumb decision here. That's what I'd be saying. But Darius had said it, so here they are. They have a desire to get rid of him. It's funny, most politicians have gotten to be great politicians by stepping on the necks of a lot of other people on their way up. Their stepping stones have been the careers of others, you know, making them look dirty. You saw in the last presidential election, it was a little while ago, and this next one's probably going to be similar. It was just throwing dirt at each other, wasn't it? It was kind of embarrassing. It was like the one was talking about the other, but there's no honor in place. There's nothing like just make the other guy look bad, and that's going to equal me looking good. But I said, you still look bad because you're throwing dirt. That's nasty. That's not honorable. But it's like the way that these politicians have made it so high, you know. They talk so nice, they dress so pretty, but not someone I would trust with a dollar of mine. I'm sorry. But that's the truth with politics a lot of times. I think Christians can be involved in politics. I think there is a special role because Joseph was there, Daniel was there, but it's difficult. And it's special people with a special desire to really use that platform for the good of God. I don't think that's something many of us could ever do. It takes a lot of qualities. Wisdom among many. Daniel had these. He was prepared for God for this job, but he didn't get there stepping on other people. He got there by being so incredibly outstanding in everything he did and being so consistent and so loyal and having such integrity they could find nothing wrong with him. Speaking humanly only, of course. Amazing person. And here he is, an old man, and had been through other empires, and he'd done so many things. I would just be in awe of someone like this. But these other men are true politicians. They're bloodthirsty. They want the job for themselves. One word, jealousy. Why did the Pharisees want Jesus out? The Bible tells us, one word, jealousy. They did not like that he was such a big authority figure when he had not earned it the way they had. They said, with whose authority do you come and talk to us? Who gave you the right to enter the temple and do this? How are you talking this way? It's the Sabbath, don't you know? And he treated him like a little kid, like a nobody, because that's what he was. Well, that's what they thought he was. And he treated him that way. But Jesus so shone with his character, his teaching. You know, one of the infuriating things to the Pharisees about Jesus was the fact that he never quoted anybody. Other Pharisees would say, so-and-so rabbi said this and this and this. It's almost like, as preachers, sometimes they like to do that, right? They're quoting one author, another, and basically, like, well, what is your opinion? Do you have one? Well, so-and-so said this, so I should think that. I'm like, well, what about you? Jesus didn't quote anybody. He just says, here it is. Here's how things are. He was the truth. He didn't need any other backbone. And scripture always supported him anyways, because that is the true backbone. The Pharisees used another code. They used the oral Torah. They used their imaginary one they'd received from Moses, which was this special extra revelation only for the Jewish leaders. And they basically with that controlled the entire society to gain what? Power and money. Very simple. And Jesus accused them of those two things repeatedly. They loved power and they loved money. And that's why Jesus said, you cannot serve two masters, God and money. You can't call yourself religious figures yet love money so much. Something fishy is going on. And you guys are hypocrites. They wanted him out. They could not stand it because he kept telling the people who they really were. And he kept this little insignificant carpenter from the middle of nowhere is telling us. Can you imagine how infuriating that would be, you know? Like, he's dressed like someone from the country. He talks like someone from the country. He's barefoot going from here to there. He doesn't have any money. What's up with this guy? We can't shut him up. Talking purely politically, I mean, that's what they were feeling. They were very infuriated by Jesus. They felt he was a serious threat, and they were right to feel that way. He was a threat to the entire facade and fraud they were putting up. They were lying to the people. In the case of Daniel, he is faced with this as well. They don't like him. He's an outsider. He's a nobody. He shouldn't be in such a position of power. Why not somebody else? And they are willing to do anything it takes to protect their position. And so one of them can become this supreme right hand to King Darius. I mean, that means prestige. It means power. It means authority. It means so many things. And all your buddies help you get there also get a piece of the pie. So it's very beneficial all the way around. What's the answer? Get rid of Daniel. Very simple. So here it goes. What do they plan? At this, the administrators and satraps tried to find grounds for charges against Daniel and his conduct of government affairs. Checking his numbers, seeing who he talked to late at night, where is he going, have any of those mafia men talking to him. I don't know. Get some dirt on him. But they were unable to do so. It says in ESV, they couldn't find any. They couldn't find any reason, any fault. Humanly speaking, he was a man of integrity, a stand-up person. What he said was what he does. That's rare, isn't it? Even in Christian circles, it's just, that's incredible, incredible characteristic we should all look to have. In the same way it says in many places in the Gospels, including Mark chapter 13, I believe, it says that they brought him into a secret council, the whole Sanhedrin, in order to find reasons to put him to death. But they could find nothing. An incredible little statement there. In Jesus' case, it was true. He was perfect. Everything they accused him of, and anything they could have accused him of, was not true. But yet, they had come with the purpose of killing him, putting him to death. And they were going to do anything in their power to do it. In the same way here, the satraps and all the governors, the other two governors, don't find anything. So they're like, well, we're going to make something up. We're going to have to find some way to trap him. Their trap was to go and talk to the king and use flattery and some beautiful buttery language to make him sign a certain contract, as you know very well. Finally, these men said, we will never find any basis for charges against this man Daniel unless it has something to do with the law of his God. He is a very religious man. So, let's use it against him. Using his integrity, his fidelity against him. So the administrators and satraps went as a group to the king and said, O King Darius, live forever. The royal administrators, prefects, satraps, advisors, and governors have all agreed, everybody except for Daniel, obviously, that the king should issue an edict and enforce the decree that anyone who prays to any god or man during the next 30 days, except to you, O king, shall be thrown into the lion's den. Now, O king, issue the decree and put it in writing so that it cannot be altered in accordance with the laws of the Medes and Persians. Something that King Darius probably changed right after this event. He's like, we're not going to do that anymore. But in this case, it stood. He could not alter or change or edit any of these laws that were signed and sealed, which cannot be repealed. So what did Darius do? Well, why did Darius sign this? He didn't know of this devious plan. What is he listening to? He's sitting there on his throne or, you know, there, and all these important men come in. His chosen administrators, counselors, and the two governors come in and says, oh, King Darius, they're bowing down, and who knows what else they're doing. And they say, basically, we'd like there to be a national holiday for 30 days, when in this time, people are going to talk about you. They're going to put up banners of you. They're going to have special ceremonies of you in every single town. It's going to solidify your empire. People are going to come together, talk about Darius, talk about his childhood, make ceremonies to him. Who knows what else? And they obviously knew this was no big deal for everybody else because the people of this culture were just like the Greeks and Romans of the later cultures. They had a lot of gods. And it was no big deal to have a demigod and also your god. So the Persian king was also always seen as a demigod. That's why Alexander the Great, when he got there, wanted to stay. He's like, man, they treat you really well here. Because he was basically treated as a god. That's how Xerxes viewed himself, for example, the husband of Esther. He viewed himself as a god. Immortal. And in this case, the king said, well, it's no big deal. They're just going to take 30 days. They're going to talk about me, do this and this and this. And then they can go back to their normal thing. And most people would think nothing of it. And it sounded very nice. What did it sound like? Oh, King, we love you so much. You are such a great person. Everybody would just love to do this. Making him feel good. They're building him up through flattery, through lies. And the king's sitting there like, wow, they really, my leaders really love me. They really care about me. They want to do this. And they're going to, they've drawn, I didn't even ask for it. What do you think? Pretty good idea, huh? I mean, you don't know why they're doing this, but for a king who's trying to enforce over 120 states your hand of control, and you're trying to solidify this empire, this isn't such a bad idea. So he thinks about it. He says, you know what? Yeah, you guys are really, really appreciate you guys. So he signs it. Signs the edict. In writing. So, cannot be altered. Which, like I said, he probably changed immediately after the future event. And now I'd like to go back to the story of Jesus. Because we're making a comparison here. Who did these leaders with these bad intentions have to convince in order to have Jesus killed? Pilate, the Roman emperor. They had, according to Josephus, they had lost their ability to put someone to death on their own for big cases like this. They might do it for a woman because in the Jewish culture and in Roman culture, a woman wasn't seen like a man. This sounds feminist, chauvinist, whatever you want, but it's just how it was. And so they could put a woman to death on the outside of a city, but they couldn't do it to a man. They had to go through the right channel to do this. And in this case, he was a very high-profile criminal, if you will. So they held, but they had two fears. That the emperor, or the governor of this, of the Judah, Pilate, wouldn't listen, and that the people would defend their famed miracle worker. So what did they do? They lied. They found a way, to capture Jesus through Judas at the middle of the night, right where he was. They brought him to a legal trial at about 2-3 in the morning. They went through this process, and they came together, put together false evidence. So they convinced themselves that he was a blasphemer. But for Rome, they had a different accusation. They needed to find someone that Pilate would understand. And he's not going to understand blasphemer. He's like, I don't care. What is he going to understand? He's going to understand traitor. And that's what they accused him. So when they drug him out at 6 a.m., they took him to the door of Pilate. The people were just waking up and rumors going around. There's a blasphemer. There's this terrible man. He's done all this. And who knows what they did? Propaganda thing, all planned to convince the people to come out. And when Pilate is sitting with Jesus, he says, what are they accusing you of? Jesus won't answer. But the accusation was what? Are you the king of the Jews? Are you a traitor to the Roman Empire? Are you trying to start a rebellion against this empire? And number two, are you trying to destroy the temple, which was built by a Roman, well, he wasn't Roman, it was Herod, but he was Edomite, but he was under Caesar, who was the governor. Are you trying to destroy a public building to make war against Rome? That was basically what they painted it at. It was so far-fetched, so dumb, so ignorant. But they also had something on Pilate. Pilate made some mistakes in the past, had done the right thing even sometimes, but the people said, if you don't do what we want, we'll find someone else. And he was kind of on his last stand. He was kind of on his last chance. He knew if I make these people angry, there's going to be another riot, another problem. The Jews are so volatile, historically, even today. But in this time period, they hated Rome over them. They hated Caesar, but they played politics. And he said, if you don't do what we say, you are not a friend of Caesar. And here's Pilate. He knows what to do. They've given him these accusations, and he sees right through them, just like Darius will in a second. 2,500 years ago, of course. And he sees it, but he can't do anything about it. And the similarity here is very great. Let's look then what happens with Darius. Now when Daniel learned that the decree had been published, he went home to his upstairs room where the windows opened towards Jerusalem. Three times a day he got down on his knees and prayed, giving thanks to God just as he had done before. Daniel, it's just 30 days. Daniel, close the windows. I mean, God can still see through the windows. We could say that, couldn't we? We could easily, and there's so many historical evidences of Christians who've given their life for something that seems trivial. I ask you, would you do this? In the time of the Roman Empire, under the Roman persecution, year 250, the Emperor Decius put in a new law. And he says, across the empire, everyone must go on a certain fixed date to the temple and give a little tiny bit of incense and burn it on the altar to Caesar. And then you walk away with a card that's written on it, Libelus, which means freed. It's almost like your ID card. You put that in your wallet, you walk around, and you were someone who aligned with the government. You were not rebellious. The Christians did not go in that line. They did not take the incense. They did not give it to Caesar, and therefore they did not have this card, and they were dead men walking. And the soldier would come and say, where's your card? We don't have one. Why not? Are you atheists? Do you hate the government? And they'd be thrown to the lions as political betrayers of an empire. Traitors. But why couldn't they do it? You have no other God before me. We will not worship in any single way in this least form another God. We will not betray him who's never betrayed us. But you think, it's so easy. It's so, just a tiny bit of money. You get a little incense. You go through the line. You throw it there. That's it. I mean, God knows, surely. It reminds me of another situation. There's these women that were in prison in Iran. This is just 2009. They're put in prison for almost a whole year. Iranian women preaching the gospel, put in prison. There's a great book on it called Captive in Iran. I was very impressed by the book. I would recommend it if you have an interest in Captive in Iran by two Christian women who were put in jail. And the government pressed them and pressed them and pressed them, saying, if you only say publicly, we do not believe in Jesus, we'll set you free. You can go back and continue doing it. They just didn't want to be ridiculed for it. There was so much international pressure from President of America at the time. I think it actually was Obama, if that was 2009, yeah. And the Pope and the President, I mean, Ahmadinejad, or dictator if you would be more accurate, was saying, let's just quietly get rid of them. Let's just quietly get them out of prison. Just have them say something public so our people don't hate us for it and don't think we're a bunch of hypocrites. And then we also make the international powers happy. They said, we will not. And we would come to them daily. What's wrong with you? We see all you have to say is a lie. And you'll get out today. Just say it and you'll be free. And he said those words. How could we be faithless to he who's never been faithless to us? How could we turn our back who's never turned his back on us? You know what? They got set free. And they did not say anything of the sort. And the government was humiliated before the public of Iran because these women would not give in. But if they killed it, these women, they would also have martyrs on their hands. So their persistence, their loyalty, their integrity was what won the day. Daniel could have closed the windows. And the story might have been very different. And God, it might have not even been the worst thing in the world. But what he did so honored God. That did what's going to happen, as we know well, but it would be so easy. I like to think of current illustrations. We don't really have persecution, do we? But it's so easy to do a little bit wrong, or just fit in a little bit more. As Christians, we're almost afraid. I think there's a great fear of persecution that's an intellectual persecution. It sounds so dumb to say, I believe in a young earth. It sounds so dumb to say, I believe in the Bible is the only word of God. Infallible. It sounds childish to believe in a man that was in a whale for 3 days and then got thrown up on the land. Like, come on. You can make up a better story yourself. And then we're like, it's hard. It can be really hard. I think a lot of people are afraid to openly say they're Christian. I think a lot of us are afraid to openly with our life speak Christ. It can be difficult. I don't think we have persecution of this kind that Daniel was going to face. The lion's den. We have other kinds of persecution. We have that shame that goes along with wanting to be a Christian. And so much attack from new atheism, from postmodernism, from tolerance to, oh, you're so intolerant. Oh, you're such a terrible person. Why would you think such a thing? We have a moral backbone. We're backed by our own constitution, but looks like things are changing. But we're so afraid to lose that freedom. Instead of saying, this is the right thing, and I would go to jail for that. I wonder, would we? Would we go to jail if we were put in a situation where we had to speak our mind on a truly difficult moral issue? Let's speak the truth and take the consequence. Daniel did. I mean, are we immune from this? Actually, the Bible says we should be counted joy to partake in the suffering Christ did, and to say, I'm with him who gave everything for me, and I want to give whatever I can back to him. To not be afraid, to not be ashamed. Daniel was not ashamed. He opened his windows. Plain day, he saw them peeking over from the other house, and he still continued to pray. He says, I'm right here. Come and get me. I don't know. Maybe you say, oh, well, he was just an old man. I'm sorry. That's hard to do. He did the right thing, no matter the cost. That's actually the topic, the title I put to this whole thing. Do the right thing, whatever the cost. And Daniel here is a great example of integrity, something I don't know how many of us would do. It would just be so easy to just say, you know what, 30 days, just not. How can we apply it to our life? What kind of things in our life are easy to say, you know what, I'll just be quiet here. I'll just change it, fudge a little bit. Do those things exist? I think we have to be a little more creative to understand how that's happening. But there's a serious temptation to do that. To fit in. To just be normal. Just be tolerant. But we need to do the right thing. What the Bible teaches. And with love, show forth Christ's love to others. We're not here to impose or beat anybody up for, you don't believe in what I do. No, the idea though is, stand firm to what you do believe, no matter the cost. 11. Then these men went as a group and found Daniel praying and asking God for help. So they went to the king and spoke to him about the royal decree. O king, did you not publish a decree that during the next 30 days, anyone who prays to any god except you, or man except you, O king, would be thrown into a lion's den? The king answered, decree stands according to the laws of the Medes and the Persians, which cannot be repealed. Then they said to the king, well, Daniel, they don't give him the title, the great governor of Medo-Persia. They call him Daniel, who is one of the slaves from Judah, right? Bringing up all his garbage from the past. Like, he's a big nobody. You knew it anyways. You made a mistake, king. They did the same thing with Nebuchadnezzar, by the way, with the three friends. Look at the language in chapter 3, I believe, when they have to go to the fiery furnace. They say, look at him. You made a mistake. They're traitors right under your nose. You put them all the way up here. Got to get rid of them. Nebuchadnezzar listened. Darius is a little bit wiser. And the same accusation, they pay no attention to you. This is a political phrase. It has nothing to do with religion. Just like with the statue, it wasn't about bowing down to the idol. In the case of the statue in the fiery furnace. Just like with this. The problem was, if they're not willing to pray to you, or to bow down to that idol, it's because they're political rebels. And they do not side with this government. And you have them in power at the very top. You must be crazy. Get them out of here. He is dangerous. He says he still prays three times a day. He ignores you. You know what? He might want your job. You know, you could, as a king, you could really be scared of someone like this. If you put a decree out, he doesn't do it. Breaking the law by the letter of the law is not outright. But this king is smarter than Nebuchadnezzar. And he sees right through. He says, wait a minute here. Then they tell the king, When the king heard this, he was greatly distressed, and he was determined to rescue Daniel. He knew Daniel was innocent. He knew why Daniel prayed. And he recognized, like, this was a dumb law to put in place. This was an absolutely stupid thing to do. What was I thinking? I got carried away by my own ego and love for self. And look what I've done. I'm going to kill the most important man in my country, and I can do nothing about it. Even though he worked till sundown to save him, he looks at all the lawyers, says, look up the books. Can I change it? Can I make an amendment? Is there some clause for an important person? Tell me, please, somebody. He's going everywhere like crazy. Been signed. Because they come, and they said, O king, remember that according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, no decree or edict that the king issues can be changed. But they were also found out. If I was them, I'd be a little scared. Daniel dies or not, you are all still dead men anyways. Worthless. Politicians. I'd still have them all hung by morning. But I'm not king. And I'm also a Christian. So let's not think about that. Remind you of anybody? Yeah, Pilate. Pilate worked every way he could to convince the people that Jesus is innocent. He tried to figure out the facts. Why are they accusing him? And it says there, he looked to free Jesus because he knew it was out of jealousy that they wanted to kill him. It says there, he knew it was out of jealousy. He knew their intentions. He knew they wanted this carpenter from a little town in Nazareth to be gone. But he also knew Jesus was innocent. He was actually surprisingly astounding in so many ways. In such a short time, he says, this man is something else. He's special. He tried with Barabbas, this terrible man, and said, Jesus or him? We want Barabbas. What is wrong with you? Are you in your out of your mind? I think looking over those decisions later on, Judas is like, well, why did we save this man again? After you hear him in the news the next morning, what he's doing, you're like, what is wrong with us? You know, but there they were, yelling, crucify Jesus, and the howling. And the people all as one yelling, crucify him, crucify him. And he said, if you do not do this, you are not a friend of Caesar. What are the Pharisees doing to Pilate? They're tying his hands politically. Whatever he does won't turn out well. He puts Jesus to death is wrong. He carries the guilt. If he frees Jesus, he'll lose his job, his family, his head possibly. Is it worth it? Just for this simple carpenter? Am I going to give up my royal position for him? I mean, he's a good guy, but I would be substituting my life for his. Very likely. With the way things are going, there was a mob happening, and they were going to storm, and they were going to kill him and make a mess, and Rome was going to, it was going to be a disaster. He said, you know what? Let's save the trouble. He worked. He did what he could. He used every element he could. But at the end of the day, his hands were tied, and he says, I just can't do it. They'll catch Jesus and kill him anyways. So he washes his hands and says, you know what? You decide. You're guilty for it. Right decision? Wrong decision? Curious question, huh? Because it was God's plan that Christ should die. What if Pilate had tried to save him? Maybe the story would have been different, but Christ would have ended up on the cross anyways. I don't know. I can't answer that question. It's not what happened. But Pilate had in him a little bit of fear as well. Actually, not a little. I think it was a lot. Afraid to do the right thing. Just like Darius. So the king gave the order, and they brought Daniel and threw him into the lion's den. The king said to Daniel, may your God, whom you serve continually, rescue you. He thought the utmost of Daniel. And he says it almost as a token, as a, your God's very honored by what you're doing. I'm sorry I couldn't do anything. It's my fault. I'd feel terrible if I were Darius at this moment. And now, not by coincidence, a stone was brought and placed over the mouth of the den. And the king sealed it with his own signet ring and the rings of his nobles so that Daniel's situation might not be changed. The tomb sealed with a rock a one-ton rock, and sealed by Pilate himself, so that it could not be changed. It is no coincidence. This is on purpose. God is telling us that Daniel here is a clear picture, comparison to Jesus Christ. Then the king returned to his palace and spent the night without eating and without any entertainment. He was a rich man. He was an important man. Could do anything he wanted to. And he's like, you know what? No Netflix tonight, guys. I'm going to bed. If you don't know what Netflix is, reading a book. And here he is. Without being brought to him. But he could not sleep. All night long, tossing and turning. He says, oh, it's my fault. Lions are tearing him to pieces. I mean, this would be an awful feeling. It's all my fault. I didn't sign that dumb... But here he is. At the first light of dawn. The first moment he can leave his palace without, you know, when the gates open, maybe it's outside of town most likely. He just takes off. Who knows? He's a horse. He has a chariot. I don't know what he's doing. But he, at the first opportunity, he's out the door. He says, I want to find out. Why? Because he thinks Daniel never really died and he's going to rise from the dead? No. Because he wants some closure on this topic. See, I just want to see his bones and hear nothing and say, well, that was it. You know, he needed to just know and somehow deal with this terrible thing he'd done on his conscience forever. Goes. The women at in the case of Jesus, went the first opportunity they could too. And it wasn't Saturday, because Saturday was the Sabbath. Jesus would have been buried on Saturday night, Friday night, before the sunset, which would be before the Saturday actually began. So he was buried actually on Friday.